The Local Thread. Welcome to The Anderson Hour, part of WGTE's The Local Thread. On today's episode, Jerry looks back at the series Rethinking Jails and Justice. The topic, police reform.
America incarcerates more people than any other country. And the problem begins in local jails. Welcome to Rethinking Jails and Justice. Now, that statement I just read you about America incarcerating more people than any other country, that statement comes from the Safety and Justice Challenge. It's a nationwide effort. Lucas County's been part of it for the better part of a decade. The Safety and Justice Challenge also says jails, local jails we're talking about on this program, are primarily meant to detain people awaiting court appearances who either pose a danger to the public or who are a flight risk. Well, with over 11 million admissions, 11 million, in fact, that number may be low, admissions to our local jails each year, those jails hold a lot of people who are neither a danger to the public or a flight risk. Let me add here, 62% of people sitting in our local jails are presumed innocent. 75% of people in jail are therefore non-violent offenses. For those reasons, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation created the Safety and Justice Challenge, which seeks to reduce local jail populations to do it safely, underscore that, while also reducing racial disparities in jail populations. Today, police reform and gun violence, hugely important issues in our criminal justice system, and no, we pretend not that we will solve those issues in this hour. We do, however, want to bring you, our listeners, the very latest on efforts in these areas right here in our local county, as well as some trends that locally based researchers are turning up on a national level that may shed some light on the best practices nationally in these areas. So, here to inform all of us are my guests, including Toledo Police Chief Michael Trendley, making time for us on what, his second day back from vacation. I have to appreciate that because I'm guessing you came home to a stack of stuff yesterday. Yes, sir. So it's good to have you. He has over 30 years in the Toledo Police Department, was appointed chief last year. He wants to talk about the department and its efforts to address the many issues uncovered by the nearly 10 years of involvement by Lucas County in the National Safety and Justice Challenge. Also here, Malcolm Cunningham. He is the director of Toledo Mayor Wade Capsicabbage's Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement. Think about it. It is in our local neighborhoods where police reforms and, yes, gun violence are so affecting the lives of local residents. And we welcomed Mr. Cunningham's informed insights. Professor Phil Stinson is here. He's a criminologist who instructs in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University. He also leads a team of researchers who track cases of police crime around the country. His data has been published in Pulitzer Prize-winning exposés, and he's observed how many police departments are handling calls for police reforms and why, in some very troubling cases, those reforms are badly needed. Chief, let's start with you. I want to welcome you in. From the days you graduated the academy, 83?
Oh, 1993.
93? I got you too old there, didn't I? All right, 93 until now, reaching the pinnacle of TPD. Have you seen the need for reforms over those years, and if so, in what areas?
So I believe every profession has to reform over the years. Every profession has to grow and change with times and with public will. I think a lot of times law enforcement is ahead of the curve. I do think we self-police ourselves fairly well. Not every agency, and I don't think every incident that occurs across this country can be attributed to every single agency. When you have more than 18,000 different law enforcement agencies across this country, you know, local to federal, there are a lot of police officers in this country. And I do think that police departments get painted with a broad brush by the actions of an individual or a police department that has nothing to do with our local community. So we are always looking at what's happening across the country, looking at events that are not good, that did not turn out well, making sure our policies don't allow that, and or that our training is specific in that our officers know that that's not what we're looking for. So we constantly look for ways to improve and get better.
The Safety and Justice Challenge, as you know, Chief, exists to reduce local jail populations, but it underscores to do so safely. One way to do that, it seems to me, if you want to reduce a population, is to put fewer people in jail, but doing that while still protecting the community. So a lot of that, doesn't that go to the very first interaction with a suspect? I mean, has that changed over the years? And if so, how?
So in that regard, policing has been the same forever, right? So someone calls 911 or an officer views a violation, and that first interaction happens with a suspect or, a crime victim, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those interactions are dictated by the person we're dealing with, how this is going to go. Now, for us, when you come to talk about keeping people out of jail, I will tell you flat out, there are certain people that need to be removed from our community for the community safety.
And even the Safety and Justice Challenge will give you that. There are people we don't, even while awaiting trial, they're technically legally innocent. That is, they have not been proven guilty. They've not been adjudicated by a judge, by a jury. That given the circumstances, what we know, they need to be incarcerated for the community good.
Yes, sir.
But when I talk about changes in first interactions, when I look at what people are in local jails for while being detained awaiting trial, drug charges, but then things that go to the situation getting out of control. Whether that's obstruction of justice, disorderly conduct, all because at that first encounter, Mike Trendley stops Jerry Anderson, and I'm a little worked up because, you know, things have been going on, and I'm a little upset, and this can go one of two ways.
Yes, sir.
Have you changed there?
So as a department and as a profession, you know, we've given a lot of training in de-escalation and training in trying to calm things down, try to, you know, make sure that everything is slowed down a little bit and that, you know, you aren't arrested just because you're worked up because you got pulled over.
Is that now part of the training at the academy?
It most certainly is.
Was it when you were there?
To a certain extent,
but
yes.
Much more now. Heavier emphasis now.
It's by far different now than it was 30 years ago.
Okay. After chasing police patrols around town for decades in my former job, and seeing folks some of the horrific scenes that they encounter, it's ugly. I've come to believe the vast majority of cops are wearing the uniform for the right reason. They are getting unfairly splashed by the muck of the occasional bad apple. But Professor Stinson, you assure me that there are bad apples out there, and in fact, in some cases, departments out there where the whole barrel has been rotten. To use your terms from earlier conversation, example, please.
An example of a bad cop?
Of a department with a bad culture.
Well, you know, as the chief pointed out, there are more than 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies across the country. They employ more than 700,000 sworn officers. So we've got a lot of things going on there. And all policing in this country is local. And I think it's important to remember that. And it's difficult to legislate changes from Capitol Hill. It's difficult to legislate changes even at the state level because you've really got to look at the needs of local communities. So certainly there are some local law enforcement agencies across the country that we could point to that have a bad culture, that have problematic behaviors that are exhibited systemically by officers, where there's either problems with the training, problems with a lack of supervision and field training, but it varies from agency to agency. And I can assure you that none of those agencies are agencies in this local area, if I were to identify an agency that's just a problem agency with a bad culture. But certainly we can think of agencies that are large urban departments that have a culture of policing that's problematic. I can also point to some very small agencies and medium-sized agencies across the country where there are systemic problems, where we see the same type of behaviors, the same types of misconduct by officers over and over and over again, and things just don't change. But again, all policing is local, and I think that the problems have to be dealt with at the local level, and communities need to be responsive to the needs of the local agency. And I think, again, that varies from place to place.
The chief first mentioned the number, but I had it in my notes from our earlier conversation, 18,000 individual separate police agencies in this country. If all policing is local, and I follow that, then all solutions must come locally.
Yeah, but I do think that there's certainly an emphasis with the Department of Justice, certainly at the National Institute of Justice, at the Bureau of Justice Assistance. There's a lot going on in terms of research to try to develop best practices, to try to get that information out there, to have supports in place to local agencies to implement different mm-hmm. types of programs that we find are successful. So there's a lot that can be done at the federal level and a lot that is being done. And I think there's some very interesting areas of research going on right now in policing. One of those is an example I'll give you is looking at alternative response methods to mental health crisis calls, co-response models where you have mental health professionals, social workers responding with the police. In some places, they're trying systems out where they have these mental health professionals who are responding in lieu of the police. Now, there are certainly some dangerous aspects to that, and we'll see how that pans out. I've got some concerns in that area. But, you know, we expect an awful lot of our police. Over the years, you know, I was a young police officer back in the 1980s, and I think since then, we've kept piling on what we expect of the police. Many of the things that the police are expected to do are frankly because they're there 24/7. Yeah. They're there to respond. And they've taken on more and more responsibilities, especially with the deinstitutionalization of the mental health system over the last 60 years, where the police are the primary responders. They're the ones that have to deal and do deal on a daily basis with people who are in mental health crises.
I will get you to many of those because one of the individual programs we've been doing one a month here at WGTE Public Media dealt with just the issue, well, mental illness and substance abuse. We had experts on our program telling us that you put those two together, they account for 70% of the local jail population. Substance abusers, people struggling with mental illness or in many cases, a combination, and that's where it becomes very, very dangerous, is the combination of both of those. So you were a young cop in the 80s.
Yeah, a long time ago.
So you got me to the 80s. So, Chief, you forgive me for my reference to the 80s earlier. You came up in the 90s. I want to get Malcolm Cunningham in here. He was part of the town hall meeting. Police reform when it comes to their relationships, those wearing the uniform, within our neighborhoods. I remember growing up in Heather Downs, down the street from where we are now at WGTE. A police cruiser comes into our neighborhood. We would run toward the street to see it. Or if it parked down at Heather Downs Park, we'd get on our bikes and ride down there. I mean, just to see the lights and the radios and the badges. And yes, that's a gun. That's a real gun. That's a real gun, Jerry. And the officers would be usually, they were so friendly and showing everything off to our listeners. I understand I'm sounding like Leave It to Beaver or Ozzie and Harriet. If you don't know what that is, ask your parents or grandparents. But I witnessed that. I witnessed that was my youth in South Toledo. We don't see that anymore. Is that even important? Or how do we heal that rift?
I think it's critical that we rebuild and develop stronger relationships between the police and community. They have so much insight into the challenges that are going on, can certainly support with investigations if that's something that they feel comfortable with within community. And honestly, it creates a stronger network of people that are committed to improving the safety and well-being of neighborhoods. I believe that community policing is a really critical piece of the entire solution. I also believe that community-based efforts at improving the safety of neighborhoods is critical as well. So, I think it's critical that we're we're able to rebuild and strengthen that relationship. I know that there's a national night out that happens within the Junction neighborhood and a few other neighborhoods within the community that's in partnership with the police and a number of social service organizations where they're really attempting to rebuild that relationship. I know that there are community officers that, you know, kind of walk the beat. I believe a few years ago there were police officers on bikes that were navigating through the community as well. I think those sorts of things are really critical because it almost always starts with a relationship that can then strengthen and kind of change the way that a neighborhood perceives policing in general, but also, you know, their individual safety.
You have some concerns, though, don't you? About, we talked about first encounters earlier. Why they're in the neighborhood and what they do when they get there. Go with that.
Yep. Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. There is a history that every single neighbor in the core area is fighting against, right? And then that's on the police side. That's also on the community side as well. I grew up in the late 80s, early 90s. I may know, Chief, through that, but I was certainly not one of the ones that was running around, right? I mean, I grew up when crack exploded.
Did you grow up here?
I did. I grew up on Pinewood Avenue, the 700 block of Pinewood Avenue, which, yeah, Chief recognizes, right? Uh-huh. So it was the height of the crack epidemic. There was.
Is that near Oakwood?
It is. It's in what is considered Junction now. I moved from there to Lawrence Avenue in the old West End when I was 16 or so. So exposed to a decent amount of gun violence, exposed to a decent amount of drugs and loss, right? And there was that always, that fear, that challenge that existed in that space, but then also the fear that comes when it's 3 a.m. And you're hearing gunshots, right? Or you're seeing a home being raided because, you know, it's right next door to a crack house or there's some sort of interaction or thing that's occurring in that space. So I think we're competing against some real structural drivers of fear, of pain, of discomfort, of distrust. And I believe that it flows both ways, just to be completely honest with you. And I think the solution is almost always going to be individual relationships, strengthening those things, but also going further upstream and addressing some of those kind of structural drivers. I don't think the police brought in the crack. I don't think that the inner city kids brought in the crack either, or the guns. But how do we address those issues in order to reduce the way that those interactions even begin to happen is where my mindset, where my my approach is.
Chief, you'll remember there was a former police chief in Toledo. I think it was under the administration of then Mayor Cardi Finkbeiner. Jerry Galvin, ring a bell?
Yes, sir.
Huge on community policing. He brought that to us, did he not?
Yes, he did.
Where are we on that?
So we still continue with community policing efforts. We have dedicated sections of community policing officers, yep. But it goes further than. Community policing is more than just having a section of officers that attend the meetings and go to the schools and do all those things. Really, community policing has to get down to the basic line officer and how he interacts on a daily basis. To that effort, that's why we've implemented foot patrols. And we've done that for the last 2 years. That's one of the things I pushed when I first took over. And we've trying to expand it every year. It just becomes a numbers problem with a shrinking police force.
There's a piece of video of you talking about that. I think it was probably when you first became chief. And you rolled this out there. Was it voluntary? I remember in the video you said you asked people if they wanted to do this, and you were surprised at the response you got. In a positive way, you were surprised.
Yes. So I was thinking of ways, how can we incentivize officers to do this program? I talked to my deputy chief, and I said, okay, maybe we offer an administrative schedule Monday through Friday, stuff like that. Figure out a way to get people to do it.
And little incentive, little carrot out there, okay.
And in turn, we had so many people volunteer to do it that we couldn't possibly use all of the volunteers.
That's getting out of your car on foot, wearing those oh-so-light, dark clothes that you guys have, and I don't even want to ask what's underneath the shirt. We know that there's protective gear down there on those 95-degree days. See, I don't want to be out. I don't want to be in the heat with T-shirt and shorts on some of those days. And you had people lining up to do that.
Yes, sir.
So, and the goal is to, while on foot out there, they're going to encounter people.
Absolutely. So the goal is to build a relationship in that neighborhood. So we selected two different neighborhoods, and that changed this year. So it's just based off of a lot of different factors. We're big into data, but we looked at our crime and different areas that we thought building a a more permanent presence in a neighborhood mm-hmm. could help us deter crime. And my goal really was this. At some point, I want our community to trust our officers more than they fear the criminal. Because in the past, we would come into the neighborhood, take the call, and try to get information, and everybody's afraid to tell us because we're going to turn around and drive out of that neighborhood and go to the next call, and that person's still going to be in that neighborhood imposing fear on those residents.
I think Phil wants to weigh in here, but while I've got you here, just for a second, Chief, so do you have enough data yet? Can you tell me, is it working, and prove that?
So we looked at our data from our very first because we started in March and ended in October, end of October, and we looked at our data, and it had minimal impacts on the crime in that area that first year.
Okay.
But really, it's bigger than just the crime.
Okay.
It goes towards that relationship, towards that trust, and the credibility in the neighborhood.
Okay, Professor Stinson, go.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking back on foot patrols. I know when I was a young police officer, you know, almost 40 years ago, I did not enjoy a foot patrol. I thought it was somewhat disciplinary, and I was interested, Chief, in your comment that officers are really interested in the foot patrol. And one of the areas that we don't talk about much in the area in terms of police reform is the whole area of officer wellness. And one of the things that needs to be a focus, and where there is a focus with certainly with the federal government and some research that's being done, is looking at officer wellness initiatives. And frankly, walking a footbeat is consistent with some of those officer wellness initiatives to get out and get some exercise and walk around the community. It has some added benefits in ways that we really don't think about very often. And I think that's important to recognize as well.
When you look at departments around the country, and you have how many researchers do you have, Phil, working with you, even just this summer?
So I have, during the summer, I have 5 full-time research assistants who are student workers who work as research assistants. And during the academic year, I have 12. And then I have a group of several professors who work in our research group.
So you have a lot of tentacles in departments around the country you're getting information from. Community policing, mm-hmm. how widespread is it? Is it a standard in most departments?
Well,
does it work?
Well, in terms of it being standard, it's different in different places. Not only is it different in different places in terms of the way it's implemented at the agency level, it's something the chief alluded to, it's also implemented very differently at the officer level, because community policing sometimes means different things to different officers, things that officers focus on, things that officers find are effective and work for them may not be as effective and work for other officers. So there's a lot of differences. There's a lot of different takes on community policing. It's kind of interesting that it's hard to define at times because it takes on different forms in different places. And things that might work in Toledo might not work in another community across the country. Things don't always work in different places. But it's interesting. You've got to give officers discretion and their supervisors discretion as well to figure out innovative responses to community needs. And part of that is listening to people and figuring out solutions. And police officers are generally pretty good at coming up with innovative solutions and thinking out of the box if they're given the ability to do so and given the trust and discretion to do so.
Malcolm Cunningham, you're in contact all the time with people in neighborhoods. It's your gig. It's your job. What are they telling you about police presence and if it's changing?
It's another situation where it varies by neighborhood, to be completely honest with you. I do know that when community officers begin to show up for meetings, begin to start to connect with and engage with community, they generally respond very well to it. You go to a community meeting, you see the way that staff are interacting, the way that community is interacting mm-hmm. with the police officer, it's clear that there's a strong relationship there and that there's an expectation that they will participate in other things. So I think about the Junction neighborhood and the community officer that's over there. I think about, they show up to housing fairs. They show up to all sorts of events and activities. They aren't just showing up when things are bad. They're showing up consistently throughout, right? It's a really critical aspect of outreach. One of the challenges that I have, I think, in general, is we always need to have a theory of change or a logic that underpins why we're doing anything, right? And with community policing, the more structure, the more thought that there is into that logic model that underpins it, I suspect that the stronger the outcomes will be. And the other challenges is just in general, community-based work is incredibly difficult. It takes some time, and the outcomes are never going to be short-term. The outcomes are always going to be things that are, you know, informal social control. They're going to be collective efficacy that changes over time. It's going to be trust. Trust is the thing that tends to drive improvements long term. And it isn't something that's going to change within a quarter, right? They're competing against a lifetime of distrust, of fear, of things that have occurred, and the spread of kind of horrific messages, whether online or you know, on the media or wherever those things are. So I think it's just a really complex thing, I guess, is a very long answer to your question.
Okay. I want to do this. So police officers, now they're going to community events. Their visibility is up. All right, there's been a horrific crime. Now the police officer comes into the neighborhood, starts asking around, and is told, I didn't see anything. I got nothing. Nope.
It's incredibly
high. That level of trust is not there.
It's not. Well, and because it's incredibly high risk for those that are willing to share information.
They put themselves in danger.
Right. And they have to balance out the possibilities of that person not being found guilty, that person never having anything happen that actually removes them from community.
That person has friends. We call them gangs.
That person has friends as well. So you're competing against kind of an erosion of trust that they will actually be protected if they do share information. So that's really, I mean, that's going to be a fundamental challenge. It's not going to be how often a person shows up in community, but it will certainly, I would say, increase the likelihood that eventually there is that willingness to share. I would actually be willing to wager that where there are community police officers and that relationship has been built, there are more people reporting incidents. I would be willing to wager that is something that could be found. Not that I've done any research on it, but
Chief, you're nodding. Chief Mike Trendley, Toledo Police. We've covered a lot of ground in the last 5 minutes you want to weigh in on.
So it's incredibly frustrating and difficult for an officer, for a detective, to try to solve a crime when they not only don't get information from witnesses, but the victim themselves will not even participate in the process because the victim, there's an old saying, today's victim, tomorrow's suspect, right? So
they're going to settle the score themselves. You guys stand down with your nice uniforms and guns and everything. I got this. You ought to see my guns.
Yes, and a lot of times it's because it's an ongoing feud where maybe they've done something to receive the reverse treatment, or they're going to get the payback themselves, and they really don't want us involved.
Wow. Professor Stinson, Phil. No, I think this was Malcolm. I want to get back to you. This may help us transition because it's really all in this together. You say there's an arms race in our neighborhood. That's scary and got my attention. But we're talking about that right now, aren't we? I got to have a gun because you have one.
Yep. And the consequences of not having a gun for them are potentially high, right? So
they're putting themselves at risk not having one.
That is the mentality that is going into that decision. The belief that other people are carrying guns is going to increase the likelihood that you carry, even if it is not actually an accurate representation of how many people are carrying guns. The risk is high.
I'm going to carry guns, and I want people to know it, because they may leave me alone.
Right.
As a nation, we spend billions on defense, hoping to never use it, when you think about it, right? But you got to have the guns. And so there we are. I do want to touch on this with Phil Stinson, who has said some very positive things about what departments are doing. I love the piece about police officers who come up with some of the most creative solutions for themselves because they're living it, they're breathing it, they know it. But you would also say, how many police officers does your program... You're tracking how many police officers who have committed crimes?
Well, I study police crime, so officers who are arrested for committing crimes, and I've studied this since 2005. And we see about 1,100 cases each year involving more than 900 officers annually on average who are arrested for crimes. And these include crimes that are committed on duty, off duty. Again, these are at agencies all across the country. I think it's important to point out that when we have more than 700,000 full-time officers across the country and a few hundred thousand part-time officers, that obviously it's a very small percentage of officers who are actually charged with crimes. That being said, we see the same patterns over and over again each year. We see troubling patterns. We see types of crimes that are troubling. We see certain officers that are assigned to certain types of police work engaging in certain types of crimes that are crimes of opportunity. So one of the major purposes of my research is to improve policing. And I think that's important to really talk about, because sometimes people seem to think that I have some sort of an anti-policing mentality, that we're somehow not in favor of policing and strong policing. So I'll give you one example from my research. And I identified this maybe 14, 15 years ago, and we see the pattern hold true. Prior research would suggest that if an officer is going to get in trouble, they're going to commit a crime, they're going to get in trouble administratively. Prior research would suggest that that would happen early in an officer's career, that they would wash out within 3 to 5 years.
If they're going to do it, it's going to happen early.
Yeah. Okay. That's what prior research would suggest.
Okay.
My research shows something different, because we have longitudinal data. And this is a troubling thing, that we found that about 17% of the officers who are arrested are arrested within 3 years of retirement eligibility. We see bumps at 18 to 20 years of service, 23 to 25, 28 to 30, and even 33 to 35 years of service. And we see it for every type of crime imaginable. It's not just one type of crime. It's on duty and off duty. But it's a large number of cases that we see each year. And it's really troubling. And what it's led me to realize is that there are some officers who appear to not have the skill set that they need as they transition late in their career to a civilian life following being a sworn law enforcement officer for many years. Because we presume that these are people who've served honorably throughout their law enforcement career. And what is it about the something in the late stage of their career? Is it cynicism? Is it something else going on? Is it that they just don't have the tools to prepare for retirement? But it's something that not only have we seen this pattern hold true every year, but I try to talk to police officers about, try to talk to police chiefs about, to get their ideas on, what can we do knowing this, to try to improve the quality of life for police officers and give them the supports that they need as they transition into retirement.
Good Lord, it's everything you've worked for 30 years, and you can retire in the police department, roughly. You work that long and flush it.
It happens. It happens with regularity. And some of these people who are convicted of crimes late in their career, depending on the state and depending on what they're convicted of, whether it's a felony or not, risk losing their pension. And that's very troubling, because they've worked a very long time for a defined pension, and then they risk losing their pension. So we have to
figure out. That's what I want to do, is trot into my later years with now a criminal record and no cash.
Right.
That's going to be a nice retirement.
We have to figure out a way to help officers. And it goes, it's consistent. The 2015 report of the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing had six pillars. And the sixth pillar, as I alluded to earlier, is officer wellness and safety.
Yeah.
And I think this really falls under the pillar of officer wellness, that we need to provide supports. And I think that, that finding from my research alone suggests that we need to focus some energies on officers in the late part of their career, late stage.
And I bring that up because when we talk police reform, I don't want to get people confused here. There is police reform with involving cops who are doing everything right. They're doing everything by the book, but we've decided we might have to revisit the book. De-escalation, some of the stuff we talked about. And we're still going to get to the mental health piece with either somebody in the car or at least on call available, all right? Then you have the piece with the rogue cop over here. Would you tell me, 20,000 police officers since 2005, 7, something like that? 23,000?
We have about 23,000 cases involving almost 20,000 officers who've been arrested for crimes since 2005.
Okay. So that is the better part of 20 years. And it's against the backdrop of 700,000 officers.
Or more.
yeah. at any given time.
Yeah, well, frankly, that's not the same 700,000 each year, so it's yeah. a lot of people. So yeah. it's, you know, depending on how you look at it, it's a small problem or it's a big problem.
It certainly, though, would again be an interruptive to good communication, trust in a neighborhood setting. Chief, what do you do to detect those situations before they become problems?
So the first thing I'd say is policing, to a certain extent, is no different than any other profession in this world. We are a group of people made up of our communities of society. So you have certain segments of our society that are going to do illegal things, and unfortunately, depending on when you're hired and what you've ever been caught for, some of those people can make it into policing. So we are a makeup of what our community is. The way we go about it is trying to identify through early intervention systems behavior that is predictive of, you know, future behavior, if you will, and try to intervene and stop that cycle and try to prevent. And then if it's somebody that's done something that's not recoverable, we're big on removing them from our department. And we've done that over the last several years, more than I'd like, actually. We're not immune from officers being arrested and convicted of crimes. Our department has seen that as well.
Nor is any profession.
That is correct. So it's about being... It's really about having your supervisors in tune with their officers and understanding what's happening. You know, some of those statistics about wellness, there's also a lot of officers that commit suicide. That is a big problem in our profession as well. And, you know, you talk about towards retirement and the loss of identity. And, you know, even just because you make it to retirement doesn't necessarily mean your finances are in a good place either. So there's a lot of things that go into those statistics, if you will. But at the end of the day, you're talking about human beings. And you're talking about a different cross-section of individuals that are wearing the uniform. And unfortunately, there is no test, there's no psych eval that will tell you exactly who's not going to be fit as an officer. And if I may,
please.
Officers, and this goes along to wellness, and wellness is a big thing for me in our department. An officer sees roughly 100 traumatic events in their career, whereas a normal citizen will maybe experience 2. That has a lot to do with the psyche, a lot to do with that cynicism, and the things that happen in an officer's career.
Sounds like the kind of things that are witnessed in war that leads to PTSD.
Absolutely. PTSD is a real thing within police departments as well.
And it's the cumulative effect of trauma, as the chief alluded to. It's something that builds on it. And some agencies are not very good at making sure that officers get the supports they need. And a lot of officers are very reluctant to take part in employee assistance programs, and you have to come up with innovative ways to give them supports that they'll actually utilize and recognize that it's okay to feel the way that they're feeling because what they saw was just out of the ordinary, extraordinary, troubling, horrific, and very traumatic.
Still, we have to admit, police reforms, they don't come easily. Following George Floyd's murder, which put so much attention, and rightly so, on police conduct, Toledo's mayor, following protests right here in our community, Chief, you're well aware of those, formed a large committee, it is a big one, tasked with researching the issue of police reform and offering solutions. One of the leaders of that group told my television audience later that some of the issues in our town are just decades old. They're very hard, impossible, it turns out, in Toledo to reach consensus on. A citizens review committee, at least one with any teeth, not doable. The effort to keep officers' records from being wiped clean just a couple of years after an officer has run up on charges, not doable. Blame police unions, if you will, whatever. The Reform Commission, for all their hard work, they didn't do a lot. I mean, I don't want to sell them short. It was a tough, tough ask. They endorsed formation of a police athletic league. Okay, well, it's tough to argue with that. But can accountability ever happen when we're shrouded with so much secrecy?
So accountability is a it's a funny word, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of times where it seems like the only accountability that's being called for is against the police.
Yeah.
Where there's not accountability for the parents, the suspects, or the person that committed the crime. There's a lot of times where they aren't held accountable, or not to enough to stop them from reoffending or continuing on with their behavior. So the biggest push is for accountability for policing. Now, look, I'll tell you, when you have that large of a protest, that large of across our country outcry, you have to pay attention and say something is wrong. To say that nothing is wrong and say, you know, all the people that are coming out to protest from every walk of life and just ignore that, then I think you're just putting your head in the sand. So there is obviously something inside our communities, whether this is the thing that the kettles that kicked it off, or, you know, people just wanted to join in, I don't know. There's a lot of that as well. But to say there's not some underlying issue, I think you're foolish.
Malcolm, you had to weigh in on this?
I agree with everything that you just said. It's a reflection of drivers of all sorts of issues that have been in our community for some time. And we have to address the issue that is in front of us. And we also have to just grapple with and understand the history that comes before, even if we aren't directly accountable for it. So I think that's something that plays a critical role.
Speaking of accountability, body cameras were supposed to shed light, reduce doubt, support, or debunk differing versions of the same event. And really, for the protection of all sides. Are they successful?
So, from a policing standpoint, I think they're very successful. I found it interesting when you started seeing organizations wanting to now ban body cameras. And my personal belief is because it didn't show what they thought it would show.
It didn't support their narrative.
No. And, you know, we talk about that too. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people that make money off of that narrative. And that's their business. And that's how they don't want it to go away. And I think from a policing standpoint, cameras have been very good for professionalizing police departments. Because now you know you're being recorded. If you're in this day and age, look, in 1980, 1990, the chances of being recorded were very small.
Mm-hmm.
In this day and age, you're going to be recorded. And for a police officer, I think it's a great protection to have the entire incident on video instead of a small edited segment.
Not only have it in Toledo, Chief, I have to tell you, because now I'm a consumer. I'm a retired guy. I get to watch the news with everybody else. I have been struck by how swiftly, when potentially explosive cases happen, the administration, TPD, has gotten the unvarnished video account of events out there. And I'm guessing to forestall violent protests and the flow of misinformation.
Absolutely.
That's the strategy.
Absolutely. And it goes against hundreds of years of policing and building investigations and preparing for trial to release evidence like that.
Yeah, it was supposed to be under wraps. It's under investigation. We can't talk to you about that, Mr. Anderson. Yeah, I've heard that. Okay.
So, but by doing it the way we do it, and I think we do it really well, we're putting that information out to try to prevent anybody from concocting their own narrative. And to, because it doesn't matter what happens, whenever we have a police shooting or something happens, immediately on social media, there's a false narrative out there that is inciting people to get angry and upset. And 2018 is when this started for us. We had an incident over off of LaGrange Street that was nearly going to turn into a riot because of some false information out there about an officer-involved shooting.
Uh-huh.
Us releasing the video sent everybody away and prevented that from happening.
I know it's all related, and this is a great discussion. I want to thank all of my guests, and we have some time here, but I want to get over more to the gun violence side. It's certainly part of all of this. And when the chief mentioned social media, it was in our conversation a week ago, I think, Mr. Cunningham, you brought that up. Like, Jerry, don't ever overlook or understate the magnitude of the impact that social media has on us. Let's talk about the gun violence epidemic. And this is not without some controversy. I'm talking about the Save Our Community effort, complete with violence interrupters. They've taken their, taken their shots bad. They've taken some heat. So the mission statement there, Malcolm Cunningham, Save Our Community, the mission statement there is what? How is it supposed to work, and is it?
Hire credible messengers from the community that have lived and navigated through some of the very challenges that are being faced in the community, and have them intervene in high-risk situations in order to reduce, turn down the temperature on incidents that may have occurred or may result in some sort of revenge or get back, to provide wraparound support to them and connect them to social services, and to help shift and change community norms around violence.
We can't address this issue with just the police department. You say there are stronger voices connected with history in our neighborhoods.
Yes, I think, and I continue to think it's a both and. I don't think it's a zero-sum game where one has to exist and the other doesn't. I do believe in community violence intervention, where credible messengers are trained in mediation and de-escalation, are able to connect people to job programs, are able to work with folks that are reentering society from jail. I truly do believe in it. I do think that we've seen success when we've had the appropriate staffing level, when we've had the appropriate supports in place. One of the challenges, honestly, is also wellness for that staff as well. Many of them come directly from the community, have experienced a number of traumas, have engaged in a number of things in their past, and are going right back into their communities. It's kind of similar to a peer support within the substance use and treatment field, right? You hire people that have experienced and navigated this work. There's always that possibility of relapse, to be frank, and there's also a number of traumas and, I guess you could say, weathering that comes with being in this field and also going back into your community, into your neighborhood. But the credibility really does matter, and is, I believe, a critical piece of making this entire work move forward.
You've alluded to, when you mentioned staff programs take funds, which I believe you feel haven't been there at least consistently enough. And since at this point, I know many listeners are thinking, here comes the money part, the big ask is throw money at it. But when talking about resources, can you also talk about the cost of gun violence to the public?
Gun violence is incredibly expensive, beyond, you know, the obvious loss that comes with devastating communities, devastating families, reducing, employment, reducing the tax base, essentially. It's incredibly expensive whenever someone is shot, whenever someone is shot and killed. We're talking about hospital costs that come with the medical needs for those that have been injured. We're talking about the actual increase in mental health services that are needed for those that are directly impacted or that have seen the incident or that are closely connected to the incident. We're talking about changes in educational outcomes for those that are living close to where the incident occurred. We're also talking about incarceration costs. We're talking about loss of potential income. We're talking about victim and survivor services funds. In Toledo, it is around $560,000 or so for every non-fatal shooting. Every single time there's a non-fatal shooting, it is about that expensive, directly costs to taxpayers. For homicide,
over a half a million dollars.
Yes.
For each shooting.
Yes.
How many shootings do we have a year? Somebody have to get a calculator out for this one, because that would be a massive number.
So, yeah, we have, for non-fatal shootings, in just under 200.
Do the math, folks. We have more guns than people in this country. I'm guessing that's also true in Toledo. Would we agree with that?
Probably.
We have more guns than people.
Probably.
For what it's worth, I've been around a long time. Maybe I'm jaded, but I don't think there's ever going to be a change in that. Everything from lobbying efforts and all of that kind of stuff. So, Chief, you talk about, and in that video, when you first became Chief, talked about getting guns off the streets. You say you are doing that. How are you doing that? How are you legally doing that?
So we legally do it through traffic stops, suspect stops.
You stop me for a red light, you can take my gun.
If you're not entitled to have it. So, and, you know, Ohio legislator for, I'm not into the politics, whether you agree or disagree, loosened the rules for carrying a gun.
Yes.
So that made it harder for us to get guns off the street of, you know, people that are going to use them in crimes. I believe, you know, in the Second Amendment, and you have the right to bear arms and you can carry a gun, and I don't have a problem with you carrying a gun. I do have a problem for you carrying a gun and using it illegally and shooting other individuals and being involved in criminal activity. So we do look for guns on our traffic stops, our search warrants, and we take just under 2,000 guns off the street every year.
How many?
Just under 2,000.
Okay. And again, our state legislature passed legislation that actually works against you in that regard.
It does in...
I mean, I said that.
So it does in...
I've covered this. I love covering the state legislature.
It makes it harder for us to get those guns. I know they did some studies that said it did not impact crime. By doing it, didn't have an... You know, crime didn't increase. There's... I would say that you're also talking about timing coming off of record high crimes when you studied it. So... It's who knows, right? But it definitely makes it harder for the officer to get guns off the street.
I'm always looking for solutions. We said off the top, we're not going to solve these issues in 1 hour. We certainly have exposed a lot of information in this area in this past hour. But I look for solutions, or at least positive action steps. So I want each of you to kind of weigh in, my guests, on the conflict piece. We can't get away from the social media piece. Professor Stinson, you're tracking a lot of people, yet you tell me you find these to be, I'm going to quote you, exciting times. You seem convinced that police are taking these issues seriously and that we now have a, in your words, ton of research on what works. So we just need to employ it. Wrap us up here.
Well, I think innovation in terms of reforms. We need to reimagine policing. We need to give police chiefs and police officers at the local level discretion to come up with innovative solutions with their community partners. And we need to make sure that we don't try one-size-fits-all solutions across the country, because typically they don't. The one area where I do think the federal government ought to step up even more is in terms of funding initiatives at local levels. And I'll give you one example. The cost of body-worn cameras in police departments is really not in the cameras themselves. It's the prohibitive cost in the storing of all the video evidence and the personnel cost, sometimes at the prosecutor's office level, in preparing all the videos for defense attorneys and preparing them for prosecutors for trial. There's huge costs involved in these programs, and the federal government needs to continue stepping up to support those initiatives, because frankly, it's not sustainable at the local level without considerable long-term financial support from the federal government.
All right, I heard some solution piece in there. I heard a call for action. Malcolm Cunningham, positivity comes what in the form of community-based efforts?
Well, across the country, there was an 11% reduction in 23, and in Toledo, there was more than a 30% reduction. That doesn't happen
in
Toledo, Ohio.
No, 30% reduction.
In homicides.
In
homicides and in non-fatal shootings. So you think about the cost savings, the actual life savings that come with that. That doesn't happen without both community and the public safety efforts from the police department. That's just it, period, bottom line. I think it requires both, and community-based efforts require funding and resources and support long-term as well. Whether we're talking about within the Save Our Community program or community-based efforts writ large, those resources need to be there in order to support direct intervention with high-risk folks in community coming from community-based initiatives.
Give me a specific, then, action step. Those resources need to be, who are we talking about? Because we're not afraid to follow up and hold people's feet to the fire.
Yep. Ensure that community-based organizations are being funded through United Way, through Toledo Community Foundation, through general fund dollars in order to do this work directly, in order to ensure that they are trained well, they're doing evidence-based practices like a Rewire CBT, like a Cure Violence, which is some of the things that we're already doing and that we're training people in the community to do.
Chief Mike Trendley, beyond an occasional vacation, what keeps you believing there are brighter days ahead? when in law enforcement, what you guys do and go on a daily basis, it can be very dark, and that can be so prevalent.
So what keeps me going is I know, you know, while we have the occasional, we call them bad apples, whatever you want to call them, we have a lot of very good men and women that are dedicated to keeping our community safe. And I will tell you that even through 2020, when it was definitely not in vogue to support the police department, we have a community that truly supports our police department. And they're maybe not the most vocal group always, but on a one-to-one basis or on the side, you get a lot of people telling you, keep up the good work, we need you, we want you, and you guys are doing a great job.
Think of those times, the nightmares in your profession. I'm thinking officer, shouldn't start mentioning names. What this community does, Chief, when we lose somebody in your profession?
Our community, so through my career, we've lost three officers. And each and every time, our community steps up and our community comes out full force to show their support, not only visually, financially for the families, for the other officers that are going through it. There is a lot of community members that come out and support our officers in those times. God forbid we have any more of those. I don't want to see those. But yeah, we actually have a really good community.
It's been my honor to MC the Safety Council of Northwest Ohio, the Hero Banquet, every year. When the folks, if you have a chance, turn out for that. When you hear the stories, not all of these make news. When you hear the stories of what our men and women who wear the uniform do and have done in the past year, and they're recognized for it, and they'll be the first to say, hey, it was just part of my job. But I'm telling you, there are people, most of us folks, when there's problems up there and you hear gunfire or something's on fire, we run the other way, and we darn well should, because that's trouble up there, and I want to save my rear end. There's something about you guys, you run toward the problem, and God bless you for doing that. And for the ones that are causing trouble, keep weeding them out. I want to thank all of my guests today for being here. Professor Phil Stinson, criminologist, instruction, the Criminal Justice Program, very good program down at Bowling Green State University. Thank you for being here, sir, and sharing your expertise. Malcolm Cunningham is the director of Toledo Mayor Wade Capsicavage's Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement. Just lit it up at our town hall last January, but the time, we had so many guests, the time was too short. Thank you for spending time with us. And Police Chief Michael Trembley, thank you for what you do in leading leading the department and protecting and serving, as it says. Appreciate it. Thanks to you as well. Jerry Anderson, I do want to thank all of you from all of us at WGTE Public Media. I thank you for joining us. Be safe out there, and let's talk again.
Thank you for joining us for The Anderson Hour, part of WGTE's The Local Thread. The Anderson Hour can be heard Wednesdays at 7 p.m. on FM 91 or anytime at WGTE.org. The Rethinking Jails and Justice series is produced by WGTE Public Media and is made possible by support from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation as part of the Safety and Justice Challenge, which seeks to reduce over-incarceration by changing the way America thinks about and uses jails.